Critically Linked, how books of the past shape our future. A DiscourseNet podcast with Dana Triff and Jaspal Singh.
Hi, my name is Dana Triff.
And my name is Jaspal Singh.
And together we are the hosts of Critically Linked, how past books shape our futures, a podcast in which we re-engage with old and sometimes new philosophers. Together with our guests, we want to explore how relevant their ideas are when discussing contemporary challenges. Today, we continue with a slightly new format.
We have three wonderful guests, Louisa Sheehy, Elodie De Souza, and Hawa Ibra Seydouwa, all of them bachelor students from UC Louvain Saint-Louis, Brussels, coordinated by Professor Thomas Jacobs. Louisa, Elodie, and Hawa will be hosting this edition of the podcast with a conversation about Stuart Hall and the relevance of the cultural studies.
Hello to you all. I'll be the host for today's podcast named Stuart Hall and the relevance of the cultural studies. My name is Hawa. I'm a 21-year-old Belgian student, and the two hosts will be Louisa.
Hi, hi everybody. My name is Louisa. I'm also a third year bachelor student at Brussels University.
And Elodie on the other side.
Hi everyone. My name is Elodie and I'm French. I'm an exchange student in Brussels for the year.
Okay, now that the presentations are over, let's start. Who actually is Stuart Hall and what are the cultural studies? Well, Stuart Hall was one of the most influential scholars in the field of cultural studies. He shaped the discipline with his groundbreaking theories on media, identity, power, and representation. Well, his work redefined the way we understand culture. His contribution remains central to modern debates on race, identity, media influence, and globalization. And so the cultural studies as a discipline, they emerged in the 50s, 60s, so during the Cold War in Britain. And they analyze how culture operates within social structures and how power is exercised through media and everyday life. And so today, cultural studies are more relevant than ever because, as mentioned, we are Belgian students, more precisely from Brussels, which is the capital of Europe, but also a city that is a melting pot. There are people from different cultures, different religions, different backgrounds, all living together and making it work. And on top of that, we live in 2025 in an era of mass media where digital platform and identity politics thrive. So Hall's theory provides critical tools to understand representation and resisting oppressive ideologies and analyzing the intersections of race, gender, and class. So now that you have a clear idea of who Stuart Hall is and what are the cultural studies, you may wonder, how did he come up with this idea? Where does it actually stem from?
Well, let's just start with the fact that in the beginning, the cultural studies was a narrow-minded idea. Stuart Hall actually was very much influenced by Marxism, but in the beginning, we just thought that culture was seen as a force and not just a reflection of economics, because if I say now Marxism, everybody is going to think about the great market, Marxism, economics, capitalism, but it's not just only that, it's also that culture is not just economics, it's also a force that influences many other things. To that, there are also key contributors, that like put their little ideas in this Marxist influence. Like Raymond Williams and Thompson, they thought that culture is also shaped by ordinary people and not just elites. So that means that I, I'm an ordinary people. I'm not rich. I don't have like $1 million in my bank account, but I can still influence you, Hawa or Elodie or someone else, to buy or to just think like me. And then there's also the Frankfurt School with Adorno or Horkheimer, that they thought that with mass culture, it also reinforces capitalism ideology and passivity. So by that, we all saw right now, especially with social media, there are this existence of influencers that want us to try to sell something, a product. And so there's really this big idea of capitalism where we more like live to work and not work to live, because we have seen all these things that we saw that we needed money, we needed this or that to evolve in our life. So it's really started with this idea of Marxism. And then there's also the idea of hegemony introduced by Antonio Gramsci. And but he said that,
sorry to interrupt. What is actually hegemony? What does it mean?
Hegemony is a term used to talk about a country or someone who is over the other, who have more power over the rest of the world or the rest of the people. And it's a term that most of the American people don't know or don't understand, because they are the hegemony for the rest of the world.
Oh, I thought that hegemony was more like the concept where it's not by fear or by caution that you put an idea in someone's head. It's more like you do it slowly. It's like soft power when you see something on the TV and you're like, ooh, this kind of sounds cool or something like that. It's not because the person on TV said, you have to buy this, you have to do like this, you have to do like that. It's more like, I feel like I like this idea.
And how do they do that?
Well, first of all, it can be on TV, but it can also be in advertisement, in an education. They present us with an idea, like, I don't know, let's take the idea of photosynthesis. It was presented to us in secondary school, and we just learned this by heart and not really try to understand the backgrounds of it. And it's more because we accepted this idea that photosynthesis happens like this, happens like that, because it hasn't been like introduced to her in the hard way, where we're like told that you have to know everything about how photosynthesis, and that it's like this, it's like that, and you cannot question it. It's more like you can think about it afterwards. And it's also was really introduced like in a slow way. It's a little bit more like when you watch a Netflix series too, you see, you see somebody drinking, and then this person is like talking with somebody else, and this person asks him, why are you drinking? And he say, yeah, because it's fun and like this and like that. And then you see a sort of discussion and how the person in the Netflix movie or Netflix series is explaining it is like, oh yeah, maybe drinking is kind of fun. It's not because he said, yeah, because you have to drink, otherwise you're not fun. It's like he introduced it in a gentle way.
Yeah, you interiorize it and then it becomes, and you do it without knowing. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, and I think that's why Hollywood has a lot of power over the world, because most of the movie we see and we saw when we were children are from the Hollywood industry.
I feel like this is mostly because of the Americanization of the world. We right now, well, earlier in our years, we all just looked at Hollywood movies. Personally, I do not do that anymore, or less. I mostly now look at K-dramas or Turkish dramas because I like them better than Hollywood, just because I realized that Hollywood portrays some kind of idea about some ethnicities and just some marginalized groups. And so I thought that they didn't really have like this good like image of how a Turk guy is, or how an Arab guy is, or how a Mexican guy is. And so I just wanted to look at other K-dramas and then dramas. And then I just learned about the K-dramas and the Turkish dramas. Personally, I like them better than Hollywood movies or something like this. But in the beginning, it was true that we just followed the idea of what Hollywood presented ourselves. So the idea that the Americans are the heroes of the world every time. I don't know why, especially like I don't know if you have seen the movie Armageddon.
No,
it's like an end of the world kind of movie. And it's always these kinds of movies always portrayed America as the hero, as the one that is going to save the rest of the world, as if there is no rest of the world. They are the world. So it's always the same. I find it really hilarious if you like backtrack a little bit and look at the greater picture to always see that it's always about America because it's portrayed in Hollywood, because Hollywood is American. So I found it funny. But yeah,
Yeah, it's kind of like in the MCU universe, in the Marvels.
Yeah.
It's America saving everybody else. But I believe that this kind of, or used to be, a dangerous way of doing, from the Hollywood way of doing with movies, etc., reinforcing stereotypes, used to be dangerous because it created an identity regarding those groups. For example, the Italian or the Irish back in the days, they used to be portrayed as, you know, gangsters, mafias, yeah, and everything. And so people kind of fit, or they were seen as mafias or gangsters, or I don't know. They were seen in the same way that Hollywood portrayed them. And so it kind of had its repercussions in the real life, and it was kind of dangerous and limited. It limited people in their own bubbles. And
yeah, well, yeah, especially what happened after 9/11. For Americans, Arabs were seen differently after 9/11. I think we all understand that they were seen like the terrorists of the world and so on. I don't know if you, Elodie, have something to say on this.
I saw something about that a few days after the attacks on the Twin Towers, and two journalists on TV were talking about the fact that people in the world were not so sad about what happened in America. People in poorest country were not very sad, and they were talking about the fact that maybe it was their fault, maybe it was because American media and Hollywood always portrayed America as a very happy country, very wealthy country where everything were fine, and for the first time something really bad happened and they were not very sad. And it was a very short conversation, only a few minutes, and a few days after, the American president Bush just didn't notice this conversation and just asked people to buy new car, because if you buy new car, terrorists don't win. And it was exactly what the problem was with the image that the world had of American. It was just the fact that, okay, we have money, we are powerful, so it's not a problem, it's not a big deal, we can just go ahead and live as nothing really happened.
Yeah, but apparently, I think I read the same thing that you did, because apparently it helped to like sell more of the cars. I don't know why people listened to him, because he presented it so well.
31% more, I think, something like that.
I find it really strange. Like, he thought that for the best of this country, it was like to upgrade some corporation and companies to promote some of the companies, like sell a car. I mean, how did he come with this idea? You just talked about terrorists attacking your country, like killing thousands of lives, and you just say, yeah, buy a car.
Yeah, it's not a problem. We can kill them in their country and buy a new car, and it's okay.
Yes, I don't know. Their idea of it, it's really weird. Is it like to, like, forget about what happened, or is it more like a sense of we have to now promote our companies, so it's going to help us? Or I don't know why he did it.
But do you think now that we live in a globalized world, in a opposition to 2001, that it could still happen now that people use, or you know, social media, and that we spend a lot more time on social media, and that we are a lot more connected in the world to one another?
Personally, I believe that right now people are like more aware, like really aware and critical about what's happening in the world, especially because, like you said, we have like digital platforms, news media all around the world. I mean, right now I can look at my TV, I can see the channel CBS or how is it called? I don't know. I forgot, CNN or something like this. So it's really easier to look at the other sides of what's happening, because especially if there's like, again, a drama that's happening, I don't know, in Pakistan, I'm going to hear it with my news channel from Belgium, but I can also look at the news channel of Pakistan if I want to. Just have to understand it and go look for it myself. And so with social media, I think it's not really any more possible to get that kind of idea to, you see a drama and somebody says, go get a car. I mean, personally, that's why I think why it's so ridiculous. And I believe that others think like that because we are more critical and more aware of what's happening around the world. Earlier in our years, fake news wasn't that popular, and right now it is. So we know that we have to be critical with the information that we get, could be on social media or can be on a news challenge or something like this.
Yeah, and I think it's easier to be sure that the information we hear or we heard are true or not, because we all know a lot of people with different background, and I think it's easier to just ask people around us if they know someone who live in Pakistan or who live in America and can just really tells us what's really happened.
Yeah, that's true. But it's also like this idea that you have to trust the people that you talk about this with. Otherwise, they also can like be a little bit cursive and like tell you something, but it's really not the case because they talk about their personal experience. I'm not telling that personal experience is not important in some kind of cases, but sometimes you're like biased. And so when you explain something to someone else, it can be a way to manipulate them consciously or unconsciously and tell them to think like this. And so they are going to think like this. But in reality, if you are objective, your meaning is not really well seen. Mm-hmm. If I say
so. Yeah, but it's exactly the same with media.
Yeah, especially with media. Like we all know, media has a lot of power, especially with their communication. They actually follow with what the Stuart Halls calls the encoding decoding concept. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Could you explain maybe for the audience, for the ones that don't know?
So media actually, so they get some kind of information, but they choose what information they want us to see and to interpret. They present it as an objective information, but they introduce it in a way to like get you a message. And so there's like the media embodies dominant ideology. For example, Arabs are terrorists. I'm sorry, I always say Arabs. It's just because it comes in my mind. And then there's like the decoding mechanism where it's the audience that chooses to adhere to this ideology. So I believe that it's true that all Arabs are terrorists, or I negotiate the message that they just said. I was like, okay, yeah, not all Arab, but some parts. And then there's also the third The third possible reaction is to oppose the message. So when I receive somebody that says all Arabs are terrorists, I'm like, no, you're totally wrong. It's not true. And then so like, something like this. So you have three possible reactions of the audience about a message that has been like sent from the media on us. But it can also not only be on news media, it can also be on social media. Influencers give us some kind of opinion or ideology. I'm not going to adhere to it. It's like the matcha. If we'd like take a like lighter theme, matcha has been like promoted everywhere around the world, but it wasn't that kind of famous. And it became famous because so many people showed it on social media and talked about it and said, oh yeah, it's so good. It's so good. Personally, I didn't adhere to that ideology. I hate matcha. I think it tastes like grass. Sorry, not sorry. But like now you see, I decoded it to oppose the message that has been sent to me.
But this is something that the Frankfurt School kind of adds a little bit of
depth
into. So mass media is used to keep us under capitalism, keep us kind of asleep, so that we are fed information and most of us, or at least a part of us, accepts this, and this, it distracts people from what's happening in the real world and the injustice and the inequality. And so it's made to distract us. Like you said, matcha, for example, you said that you decoded it and you hate matcha because it, you don't like it. But a lot of people, because they were fed the idea that matcha is great, matcha tastes good, matcha is popular, they like it and they interiorize it. And so this was the, one of the ideas shared by the Frankfurt School that, you know, mass media distracts us and makes us not to be inspired anymore. What do you think about this, Elodie?
I think that if media don't succeed, when they don't succeed to convince you that it's good and you have to share the same idea that the rest of the world, you're some kind of marginal people. And that creates marginal groups. And that's what Stuart Hall thought, that it's marginal people that can change the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the representation, because their ideas are like opposed to the general main idea. So they're always seen like the pariah of the group because they don't think like the rest of us. But sometimes their reasoning is valid. Like,
yeah.
Like again, with the matcha, it's not because you don't like matcha that you're like, I don't know, the worst kind of people on earth or something like this. Just they have some idea of the popularity of matcha and the taste of matcha that the others don't like. But you don't have to say, oh, so you're weird if you don't like matcha or something like this. Like you have to exclude them of the discussions that are going around the idea of matcha.
Yeah, but, and it's this marginal groups that create the most important movements in the world. For example, in the 60s and 70s, the Black is Beautiful movement and Black Lives Matters. It is marginal groups.
Yeah, true. Again, it's like now, right now, we are more like touched with it because of social media and news media, that some of them are transparent, but it's really important to keep that transparency and authenticity of the information to show us also what the marginalized groups are doing and how they present themselves. Because we have for so many years, we have like seen one kind of idea, opinion on these marginalized groups. So it's really interesting to see their side of the story, must I say. It's like I said, with the MCU really changed a lot of things with the soft power. But right now they introduced like new superheroes that like Black Panther, Disney 2 introduced like new Disney princesses of Mexico and something like this. So it's really nice now to see that they are represented. Maybe not in the best way, but they are represented at least in some ways correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I don't know what you think about, like right now we talked a lot about the mass media and so too, but I feel like communication also goes through the corporation and the organization and companies that we adhere to, like Tesla, Nike, or other things. I don't know how you feel like communication goes through with them.
Well, nowadays, the companies, they function by creating their own personalities. Nowadays, at least the young, everybody can relate to the companies. People kind of are attached to a few big names, big corporate names, Apple, Microsoft, Coca-Cola, and they have a tight and fusional relationship with those companies, with those labels, because they feel as if they share the same values of, for example, as you mentioned, Tesla. Tesla characterized itself, Elon Musk characterized Tesla as something revolutionary, new. And if you're into those idea, you may feel attracted to that label and to this or corporation. But the danger to that is when the individual promoting or the individual representing that label is not liked, or well, is disliked or problematic, such as Elon Musk. It may also bring the company down, as you may or may not know.
Yeah. Apparently, their stocks like downgraded a lot. Now many people don't buy. Yeah, and it's a little bit not wrong, but it's sad to see that because of one individual that represented this company, everything goes badly for the company itself, even though they're like connected to that individual, but not really. And so it was really fun in a way to see that because of who Elon Musk is represented as, that now selling cars for Tesla is really hard. Like right now, people are just like reselling their cars because they're like, no, because they associate immediately Tesla with Elon Musk. So everything goes back to Elon Musk. If he does something wrong, then people are going to say, okay, but well, I'm not going to buy Tesla. It's like the idea of boycott, especially now.
But once again, it's directly linked with the media, because none of us ever met Elon Musk.
Yeah.
The only image and idea we all have of him or Donald Trump are images we saw on medias.
True. Yeah, that's true. It's a little bit like this for everybody. I mean, I've heard something like this on this part of the world. Like, I don't know what's happening in Argentina, but I heard somebody talk about Argentina. I don't know what's happening in real life in Argentina. I just know what I've heard of someone that lives in Argentina. So I don't know. It's not like we are talking about something that's happening in Brussels that has affected us personally. At that point, again, we can talk about it freely and we are going to understand with us three, but others are not maybe going to understand our reasoning and our kind of thinking because they haven't lived what we have lived. Or they don't know this person, but we know this person. Yeah, it's also this. It's also, like, again, the representation of how mass media, well, no, it's how mass media represents somebody. But I think that now it really evolved because, like I said earlier, with social media and other platforms, you really get now in touch with other parts of the world and actually the real beginning of the story in someone else's history or life. So it's kind of easier now with mass media and so on.
Yeah. Well, it's through media and ads and publicity that the organizations and that the corporations, they share their narratives, you know, their mission, their vision and their values. Could you maybe elaborate on what it means and what it signifies?
Like you said, with Tesla, they had this mission and core value of we are now the next generation kind of this technology, we promote sustainable energy, we are bold and something. They really represented themselves like this. Nike is represented as strength or like coolness and like sports activity. And they really represented with their ads, like their campaigns, they're going to take some people to represent ambassadors. They're going to represent this company or this brand or something like this. So branding also is really important. And branding actually is linked with articulation, another concept of Stuart Hall, where it's like a link between cultural values and a brand identity. Again, with Nike, you have Nike strength, and so it's selling like sports. How do we call it? Sports
gear.
Yeah, sports gear and sneakers and so on. And Nike actually took that and like linked it with social justice. You don't really understand the link, but right now you don't unsee it. Like when you talk about Nike, when you see some of their campaigns and ads, you know they always like a link with social justice. Another example is with Ben and Jerry's. It's also like really doing social justice. The ice cream company is really into the social justice, but it's an ice cream company. So you see how they evolved to like really present their brand and their core values with what's happening right now inside the world, especially while they are like, they do the social justice with what's happening in Gaza, and they really have a stance on this subject, even though they are a branch of a bigger company called Unilever that doesn't really talk about this. So they really took a stance and they said, it's not because I'm into something that's happening right now that I don't really have my brand core anymore. I still have my values. I still have my identity. I just adhere to some ideas on what's happening right now on social justice, for example. I don't know what you girls believe.
Yeah, totally. So I was actually thinking of Ben and Jerry's when you were talking about it, because it's one of the main examples that came to mind because of the recent event. You know, one of the founders was arrested because he was protesting for a ceasefire and peace in Gaza. And so, yeah, this is something that can be seen in almost every corporation, because every corporation has to create, you know, its identity and has to relate to some values that can be shared with their public. And that's how they get loyal customers.
But it can be kind of tricky because then there's like this idea of co-opting, like you tell, yeah, I am against this, I am against racial injustice, but if you don't really show like genuine support, it's going to backlash, like what's happened in like 2017 with a Pepsi ad with Kendall Jenner. I don't remember what's happened, but it was also like Pepsi wanted to show that they were with the people, but because they used Kendall Jenner, it backlashed and like people like protested against this ad, and like after 24 hours they took the ad away because it just the audience felt like it wasn't like genuine support. They were just doing it to have the fame or to have people buying their drinks. That's it. So it can backlash.
Yeah, of course, but it has to seem genuine, because if it isn't, then people are going to notice. They create a narrative because it creates an identity. The identity has to seem genuine, or else the people are going to feel fooled. They're going to be like, "But you just want my money."
So it has to follow the narrative. If you like, I don't know, your narrative of your brand is like ecology, everything, and then I don't know how, but you talk about the save petrol or save the petrol thing, you're gonna like, huh, but your narrative is not the same. What are you talking about? Why are you defending this when your narrative is this, when I've seen your brand as like an ecologist company or like sustainability and you're trying to defend petrol? Like, it's not going the same way. So you really have to not to be too far away of your identity, otherwise you're, like I said, backlash, like you said, Howard, too.
Yeah, and now people really want companies and personalities or artists, singer, to have an opinion and tell their opinion.
Yeah, also, that's true. Because some brands and companies use celebrities as their ambassadors, like as their promoters of like the, like they think that, like when you see Hugo Boss, you see Theo James. I love him.
Yeah. But
you directly when I tell you, yeah, have you seen the last ad of Hugo Boss? So many people are going to think Theo James, but Theo James, first of all, he's an actor, he's a celebrity, but he's now linked to Hugo Boss because he is seen as somebody apparently that goes with the idea of Hugo Boss, and now you just make the link immediately. It's like with Nespresso. When I say Nespresso, who do you think of?
George Clooney.
Thank you. Yeah. Because you have that this kind of charm and so on, and because if you like George Clooney, then you're going to like Nespresso, because you'll be like, why is George Clooney doing a promotion for Nespresso? It means that it's really cool Nespresso, so I'm going to buy Nespresso. So who they're using to and what they're doing with their ads is also really important. It's like the symbolism and the identity, just like Rolex, you know, with the like really rich, smart, well, the watches. It's like shows, if you see a Rolex ad, you're like, okay, that's for the rich people, that's for the highest elites and the people with the utmost status. And you know you're not going to be interested in a Rolex because you cannot afford it, for one. And two, you maybe feel like you're not that kind of person that can go buy a Rolex. But I feel that that really has changed with the influencers. When you see like an ordinary people that has gained some celebrity, and then you see that they are going to buy a Chanel bag, the last Chanel bag or a Hermes bag, maybe you're going to feel like, maybe I can also buy it in Hermes bag. And you know it, that you don't have the money for it, but because you have followed an influencer that started with nothing and now has, I don't know what, you feel like, okay, ordinary people can go buy a Chanel, can go buy, I don't know, the last Armani or something like this.
It's just my opinion, but I feel like influencers are the modern version of both the American dream, but on social media. And do you remember programs on TV during the morning to just influence people for buying some new product to clean their house or something like that?
Yeah, I remember.
I really feel like influencers are just a mix of these TV shows and the American dream.
Yeah, it's true.
In the sense that they sell you a dream that may seem close, but actually is far, far-fetched.
Yeah, that's true.
And actually, since we talked about also globalization, you know that all of these brands, such as, you know, McDonald's, are getting implanted everywhere in the world right now. And how do you think that they can, you know, manage the cultural culinary aspect of the place where they are getting implanted it and keeping their signature? Because Stuart Hall, he talked about cultural adaptation and localization and cross-cultural branding, but what does it actually mean and how can it be now implanted?
Actually, with the concept of localization, it's like mixing global identity with local culture. It's like what McDonald's has done when they planted themselves in like some part of some regions in the world, like in India or in Pakistan. They have a menu specifically for that, or they are not going to sell some kind of meat, or they're going to do like in India a tikka masala menu or something like this. So they try to implement themselves, but also respecting the culture where they have implemented themselves. But sometimes people don't really like it because they feel like they are losing their culture, like what's happened in Italy. McDonald's actually wanted to plant it himself on a really famous place. I think Duomo, I forgot the name, but it's like Duomo in Florence. But like the Italian population was like against it because they thought that they're going to wash away the importance of this place and their culture. And so they decided against too. So yeah, there's also like the cross-cultural branding where there's a blend between global and local. And I believe that if they want it to work, they have to like have a localized storytelling. So not a global storytelling about McDonald's, but also why do they implement themselves, for example, in India, have like a localized storytelling, have maybe a partnership with local creators, like influencers there, or just be a little more flexible. We don't ask to like change your whole brand core, just to adapt yourself from where you're going to plant yourself in.
Yeah. And so do you believe that this can be done with every type of label of organization, organization, for example, clothing brands? Can this also be done with clothing brands, or is it only limited to corporations that sell food?
No, because if you think about it, I'm really fan of Adidas clothing, but in China. I don't know if you have seen some merch, but they're really different. Their clothing there in China are really different in ours, because they adapt themselves to which country they are going. But personally, I love Adidas clothing in China. I prefer these than ours. But you see that everywhere. Like, there are some brands that also don't want to implement themselves in some countries. Like, for example, I still don't understand why we don't have a Sephora here in Belgium.
Yeah,
still
great.
Don't understand why.
It was so disappointed for me when I arrived.
Yeah. But it doesn't stop ourselves to go on the frontier and go in France and go buy something in a Sephora. But yeah, but that's another subject. But like you said, with the clothing, we know what Adidas is, but they still try to like mix the culture in which they have the country in which they have implemented, to like adapt themselves with their audience and the clients for which they're going to sell their clothes. We have like more laid back, like more open stuff, and for example in China or like in more Asian countries, it's like more reserved, modest clothing than in our countries, in Western countries.
I think that if a company really want to change something, they can. It's just a question of will.
Yeah, it's a matter of will. Yeah, I believe that too. It's just, if do you really want to? Because there are so many kind of possible ideas that you can implement. So if you don't do it, it kind of means that you don't really want to, like you don't really adhere to the culture of another country. You don't really want to adapt yourself. And I feel like it's really important, because we don't think all the same, even though they want us to think all the same. We don't always think the same. We have our own opinions and culture. So for me, if you cannot adapt to one, it means that you don't really, like Elodie said, have the will to do so. I don't know what you think about it, Hawa.
Yeah, I totally agree, because, I mean, there's always a way in which you can try and find a match with the local population and find an equilibrium between you, the corporation, and the public that you're trying to reach. So if an organization doesn't want to find that equilibrium, then it's best maybe to not get implanted there.
Yeah, true. And that's again how the organization and the companies communicate themselves. They have to like communicate in a way that you feel like they're open-minded, that they are open to come in your countries and implement them there too. And if you feel like it's not that case, then you're just going to be against that brand unconsciously or consciously. You're just going to be like, yeah, but I don't feel like they're genuine enough to be open-minded to come here. So no, I'm not going to adhere to their clothing or their food, or I don't know what they're selling.
Exactly. And that's what cultural studies is all about. It critiques, it advocates for inclusive representation and decolonization of knowledge, which also involves the fact that accepting the difference of the countries in which you're going, and inclusivity, actually.
Yeah. Stuart, all ideas was that identity is not something fixed. It's something that can change, influenced by the people around us or the country where we live. For example, he was born in Jamaica, but he always feels like he was both Jamaican and British.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. the identity is not something fixed.
Yeah, it can evolve. That's true yeah. too. Slowly but surely it can evolve.
Yeah.
But do you believe that Stuart Hall really changed the game in what's about like culture and communication in its whole, or do you feel like it's his ideas were still unclear, that he didn't really change much to now society?
I think that it changed a lot of things, but just recently, for example, I discovered that his essays and article were only translated in French a few years ago.
Oh,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Okay. Wasn't that popular in our countries, like French countries?
It wasn't very popular, no.
Was he popular in English-speaking countries or not even?
He was most popular in English-speaking country because he co-founded a university and centers for cultural studies researchers. So he was most famous in English-speaking country, but not in French-speaking countries.
Okay. And now that, you know, the translation of his works in multiple languages has begun, do you believe that he has left a heavy legacy for the other scholars or experts?
I feel like yes, in some kind of way, because he really deconstructed the idea that communication is not a tool for power, because it is. We have seen it, we live in it, we are influenced by the communication of so many other people. It can be around us, or it can be on media too. And so I believe that it really helps us deconstruct the power in today's digital, but also branded world with the companies and organizations too. And with his ideas of articulation, representation, and encoding and decoding, I feel like right now it's really true, because he has, yeah, like you can put in real life and in practice what he has said. But in many, many researches, sometimes there are like holes in his essays and so in his ways of thinking. But for me, he is an important figure in communication and communication studies. Mm-hmm.
Definitely, his research and idea were not perfect, and most of the criticism we can hear about him are about the fact that women were not included in his ideas, and most of the time he had ideas, but he never gives solutions.
Yeah, it's like throwing, yeah, I say this, but what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but that's a little bit about everything. All researchers just tell us, yeah, it's like this, but they don't really try to give us a solution. They just tell us, this is wrong. Okay, what do we do about it? I don't know. You tell me. But I feel like he also opened us the way to critical thinking. We now yeah. are all more aware of what's happening in around our world. So I believe that he's an important figure to understand and to analyze, even though true, he doesn't really talk about everything and he doesn't give clear solutions, but he gives us some time to like interpret and like understand what.
Yeah, a sort of guideline.
Yeah, a guideline to like, be aware of what you receive, be critical, like look into things. Don't just be a sheep that follows the farmer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm totally in agreement with you. Well, the time for goodbye has come. But before leaving you all, I would like to conclude on what we talked about, just like Louisa has just said. Stuart Hall, he reminds us that meaning is never neutral. Culture is not naturel, it's constructed, contested, and can also be strategic. As always, understanding articulation, hegemony, and representation empowers us to see through dominant narratives and imagine alternatives. But nowadays, we live in a world flooded with brands, media messaging, and cultural battles. Paul reminds us to think and observe in a critical way to have the strength to see and understand it for what it is. So on that note, I would like to thank you all for being here today with us. And see you next time.
Thank you, guys. Thank you,
Hawa.
Bye. Bye.
Bye-bye.